RN, your world unfolding.
On RN and online at abc.net.au/radio national, this is Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for your company. Tonight, grey literature, and no, we're not talking about salacious writing or shades of grey. Instead, we're looking at the ever-expanding volume of discussion papers and reports produced and published online from non-government organisations, think tanks, academics, researchers, and industry and lobby groups. It's called grey literature because typically it's unregulated and beyond the scrutiny of peer-reviewed journals or public service processes. But is grey literature credible? Does it genuinely add to our store of knowledge, or will much of this digital scholarship become digital dust? As you'll hear tonight, capturing, accessing, and keeping all this stuff that's published on websites is a big issue for researchers, librarians, and archivists. On one level, grey literature challenges the formal research publication system and can be seen as opening up or democratising this closely guarded space occupied by refereed journals. But critics say, while grey literature can make a big splash, it can also sink without a trace. Much of it, they argue, is ill-informed propaganda or glorified press releases put out simply to influence policymakers. On Big Ideas, let's head now to the National Library in Canberra. The conference is called Grey Literature: Where is the Evidence? And we're bringing you some of the highlights. Later on, you'll hear a discussion on the challenges posed by the rise and proliferation of grey literature. But first, Professor Julian Thomas with the opening keynote address. He's the Professor of Media and Communications and the Director of the Swinburne Institute for Social Research, as well as being Chair of the Management Committee of the website Australian Policy Online. Professor Julian Thomas.
The question that we've asked in the conference title, where is the evidence, obviously responds to that very familiar, perhaps over-familiar, call for evidence-based policy. Maybe more of an idea than a reality, but from our point of view, the answers to that question, and there's more than one answer, but the answers to the question of where is the evidence turn out to make a real difference. It actually matters where the evidence is, it matters what form the evidence takes, and it matters who is in a position to find it. Grey literature, in the form of reports, blogs, papers, presentations, is produced by a remarkably diverse array of institutions, including university-based centres, think tanks, consultancy firms and private research agencies, NGOs, international bodies and government agencies. It's often distributed on a website, outside conventional channels, without the involvement of established publishers. So when we're thinking about grey literature, when we're thinking about what it is, we're usually thinking about one or more of those three attributes of greyness, if you like, the nature of the document, the source of the document, the way it's distributed. That sounds fine, but there turns out to be nothing neat, really, about those, about the distribution of those attributes, because documents usually occupy a place on what we might call a grayscale spectrum, rather than an unambiguous position on one side or another of the divide. Beyond the question of definition, I think there are some potentially useful ways of conceptualising grey literature, and I want to just take a little time to talk about those and how they might be useful. So how do we think about this area? It's a well-known problem, a highly developed subject in the field of information science. That's not my area. Outside that domain, I think there are lots of interesting sources, lots of interesting literature that helps us. We can draw upon the scholarship of the informal economy, for example, beginning with the work of development economists and anthropologists who began to take seriously the off-the-books, unregulated economic activity in the developing world in the 1970s. It may sound like a tangent, but what we're doing here is we're not thinking about grey literature in relation to other literature, in relation to other publishing practices. We're thinking about it in relation to other grey markets. Subsequent work in the field of informal economics has pointed to the persistence of informal economic activity. It's flourishing in the West, despite the assumptions of many scholars and policymakers. And the especially important creative tensions between the formal and informal sectors. I won't say more about it now, but I think grey literature can be understood as a kind of informal publishing, and that's a word that we've used in our project description extensively. A kind of informal publishing, something accessible and possible outside traditional industry structures. So there are similarities with other grey markets, things like parallel importing, things like second-hand markets, that sort of stuff. Like other informal activity, grey literature is remarkably resilient. It's enabled by new technologies, and it's also deceptively important for the formal sector, with which it is completely and necessarily entangled. So that's one idea, that idea of grey literature as a kind of informal informal economic activity. Another way of thinking about the distinctive features of grey literature is to consider what some cultural sociologists would call the field in which it's produced, the networks of people, relationships and institutions that make it possible. In the world of conventional publishing, if we look at that, the field is composed of publishers, editors, distributors, retailers, agents, and authors, although the last of those turn out to be surprisingly kind of disconnected from the others. And if you look at the field of conventional publishing, one of the interesting things you see is shifting power relations among it. So power has shifted in the publishing field, with publishers increasingly squeezed on both sides by new retailers and distributors, people like Amazon. I don't actually know if there's anyone like Amazon, but Amazon. And on the one hand, and on the other hand, the increasing power of agents and a star author system. Now, the field of grey literature is almost unrecognisably different from book and journal publishing. It consists of funding agencies, it consists of consultancy firms, universities, research centres, think tanks, public sector bodies and NGOs. But here also there are distinctive and somewhat fluid power relations at work, especially between funding bodies, universities and the creators and users of grey literature. And so the result is a complex web of competing incentives which we need to untangle. I think with these sorts of perspectives in mind, we can begin to describe the conditions that have led to the contemporary profusion of grey literature. These factors are technical, institutional, and economic. Often they're all those things at once. The first of them, probably the most obvious one, is the digital disruption. Clearly, digital publishing and distribution have enabled low-cost production of grey literature using whatever tools are readily at hand. Some of those tools turn out to be great, tools like, you know, blogging software. Some of them turn out to be fantastic but also problematic in some respects, like PDFs, for example. PDFs turn out to be originally devised in order to meet the imagined needs of the paperless office as it was envisaged in the late 1980s and the early 1990s. It wasn't really designed as a network publishing system at all. In my case, I don't think it succeeded in producing a paperless office. I'm not sure about other people, but they're obviously completely ubiquitous on the web. The other key element, I think, that is really important for the profusion of grey literature is the distribution, the redistribution of research capacity beyond traditional centres, beyond traditional institutions. I've talked about the range of producers of grey literature. That reflects the complexity of the research landscape we're now in. We have a lot more PhDs. They're doing research. They're not all in universities anymore. The third thing, I guess, coming from is more a kind of on the demand side, the popularisation of the evidence-based policy idea necessarily creates a continuing interest in readily available, up-to-date research findings. The actual practice of evidence-based policy we can argue about, but it's clear that all policy development work stands to benefit from easy access to current research from the full range of diverse sources. Thinking about the funding for the production of grey literature, clearly it comes from a multiplicity of players in that more complex, more distributed research landscape that I talked about, and it comes at multiple levels, at international levels, national levels, and below. So you have a plurality of funding sources, and what follows from that is a plurality and complexity of funding models for the production of scholarly literature. Multiple potentially contradictory objectives and incentives. For example, funding models for research that emphasise that outcomes should be accessible, that they should be published in high-quality outlets, that researchers should increasingly collaborate with industry and government, and that publicly funded work should have tangible impact both within and outside the university. So the effect of these is to provide both incentives and disincentives to publish informally. The other element, I suppose, that is vital is that grey literature, like other kind of informal activities, is also clearly a response to what are now widely recognised deficiencies in the formal research publishing system. These are pretty well known, I won't go through them in detail. The cost of journals and books, the inaccessibility of journals outside university libraries, the delays in publishing, and the uncertainty as to what kind of quality assurance peer reviewing actually provides turns out to be not exactly what people outside universities might expect. I won't say more about those things now, but they are definitely drivers. We often think about grey literature in terms of what it fails to be. It's not peer-reviewed. It lacks bibliographic information or other useful metadata. It escapes collection and preservation. But it's important to remember, I think, that the deficiencies of grey literature, from one perspective, may at the same time be advantages from another. And this also helps to explain just how grey literature has proliferated. It is an opportunistic creature of the dynamic field of scholarly or research publishing, and in particular all those various incentives and disincentives that I mentioned about. And that means that there's a certain kind of complexity to it, what we could call the double edge of grey literature. One example of that, we often associate grey literature and its profusion with open access publishing and the open access movement. Clearly, the desire to make research accessible in a timely fashion is one of the main incentives for producing a report or a working paper and putting it free on the web or in a university repository. But there's no necessary link, of course, between informal publishing and open access. As my colleague Amanda Lawrence has talked about in her recent historical survey of this problem, published in the journal Media International Australia. Nice to see it formally published, Amanda. As she said, the desire to restrict or control access to research remains an incentive. A hard-to-find technical report may be deliberately hard to find, and a great deal of research remains intentionally restricted in circulation for commercial and other reasons. On the other hand, the relative simplicity of grey literature publishing practices, that point I made about the way it uses the tools that are available, that are readily to hand, means that potentially at least preservation and access can be relatively straightforward compared to the increasingly restricted platform-specific domains of commercially published e-books. So all these pressures help to explain what I think is an apparently contradictory situation, where while the academic research system is increasingly organised and formalised with strong incentives for publication in peer-reviewed form and a whole range of evolving systems for measuring research quality and impact, at the same time we see this remarkable profusion of informal academic publishing. It's been happening a long time. Let me finish these remarks with a little bit of reflection on our experience in this field. 10 years ago, a few of us at Swinburne's Institute for Social Research set up the website Australian Policy Online, which many of you may know, an online gateway to public policy-related new research in Australia. We created it because we'd seen from the mid-1990s onwards that proliferation of websites created by lots and lots of mostly really small research centres, both in universities and outside them, right across Australia. Oddly enough, APO has survived after many years and a number of technological revolutions. We didn't really have the words to describe it then, we didn't articulate it this way, but what we were actually trying to do, it turned out, was build a kind of policy library of grey research literature. And we've been working on improving it ever since. But while I think we've done extraordinarily well with that, we realised that things like APO can only go a very small part of the way towards resolving the issues around grey literature. Some of those problems, as you know, are to do with law and policy. They're to do with copyright, where, for example, sites like APO are currently prevented from providing more useful, linked, full-text archives of relevant material. We can't connect the literature together in the way that we think we can see would be really useful. Some of the problems are obviously technical ones. These range from the limitations of the tools that people use to create and distribute literature, and also to issues around the lack of larger infrastructure. Some of the problems are institutional, a lack of coordination. There's also, and I think this is really why we started this research project, a lot that we simply don't know about who uses and produces grey literature and about how we can use it better and how its functioning in our research and innovation systems can be improved. A diverse, complex research landscape of the kind I've been talking about can only be a good thing. It could be a good thing for many reasons. One of them should be more informed and robust policy debate. But that depends on knowing where the evidence is. I hope we can learn a lot about all of those matters today. Thanks.
Julian Thomas, Director of the Swinburne Institute for Social Research and Professor of Media and Communications at Swinburne University of Technology. He was the opening speaker of last year's Grey Literature Conference at the National Library in Canberra. On RN and online at abc.net.au/radionational. You're with Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. Next up, to examine some of the challenges posed by grey literature, you'll hear from the ANU's librarian, Roxanne Massingham, Amanda Lawrence from Australian Policy Online, Jerry White of the Australian Council for Educational Research, and Derek Whitehead, Swinburne's Copyright Officer. To start the ball rolling, here's our moderator, Crikey's Canberra correspondent and former public servant, Bernard Keane.
I'll just talk briefly about where I'm kind of coming from on this issue, and I suspect perhaps the reason why I was asked to come along and contribute is that there's been a rise of grey literature in the public policy space over recent decades, but a lot of it's counterfeit grey literature. A lot of it is propaganda and self-interested polemic masquerading as grey literature. And it's increasingly infecting our public policy space and playing quite a significant role. And its origins are kind of fairly complex, and I'm not going to go through them all because they, you know, they go back to things like, you know, what the Hawke government did to the public service. But in essence, what we're seeing increasingly is the template of grey literature, the template of rigour, of independent thinking and analysis taken by those with a particular agenda to push in public policy and exploited to kind of masquerade as an authentic contribution to public debate. And it seems to me there's a significant degradation of public debate going on. And the authors of this sort of ever-growing tide of faux rigorous material, there's a certain sort of group of usual suspects. It's coming from industry groups. It's coming from big companies. It's coming from some NGOs. It's coming from particularly from think tanks. And the specific authors tend to be also a bunch of usual suspects, economic modellers, a lot of them based here in Canberra. But the thing that they all have in common is this pretense of rigour, is the sort of the replication of the things that you expect to find in both peer-reviewed material and in grey literature, authentic grey literature. You know, there's the word report appears on the front page. There are graphs and tables. You know, there is modelling. There's a methodology there. The people writing the report have got credentials and qualifications, but it's all garbage. Designed to influence public debate, designed to give a media campaign a particular focus. Routine with these reports is that they're produced by companies and they're dropped on journalists confidentially and then released basically via a newspaper report. And certain newspapers do it more than others. But the goal ultimately is trying to influence the public debate. And one of the problems that we've got is that while there's been this rise and rise of inauthentic, faux rigorous grey literature, the capacity of our key institution for filtering a lot of this stuff, the media, to actually filter it properly has been diminishing. There are fewer and fewer journalists. They are being asked to produce more and more content across more and more platforms. They're being sacked left and right. Journalists don't have too many of the skills, and they don't have the time to actually go through these reports and realise what a load of rubbish they are. And so there is this sort of, what I think is this sort of slow, steady poisoning of the quality of public debate in Australia, directly as a result of one of the issues that you guys have been throwing around today. And I think I gather this sort of issue hasn't been touched on too much, but I want people to think a bit about the role that the three key stakeholders in this whole issue have in, I guess, to kind of state it very melodramatically, combating, you know, this rising tide of stupidity, as I call it. So to get discussion sort of underway, I want to throw to the panel and say, am I being too pessimistic in that assessment? And are we, in fact, in some sort of, you know, is it arguable that we're actually in some sort of information nirvana in which we have so much information that, we're actually much better off than we were 20 and 30 years ago when it was much, much more difficult to obtain information for policymaking purposes? Thank you, Roxanne.
Absolutely great comment. And we were just having the discussion before about, you know, what is quality and what is crap. And it's true that the volume has brought a degree of confusion about what is real. And the other thing that I think is very true is that we've seen an increasing sophistication that you've talked about in terms of presentation. So when you see something and it's from the latest greenhouse group, you don't know if it's pro-coal or anti-coal because of the way the document's presented.
I think the anti-coal ones are the ones with the greenest sounding name.
Usually are. And I think part of the challenge, you know, my librarian heart and my research heart says what we need to do is actually capture these so that we actually are able to track what an organisation is presenting, because if you just have one and there's no website, there's no other contextual information, they often get greater credibility, I think, than if you have a whole body of knowledge so that you can actually see these people are traditionally, you know, pro-coal, they're using a banner, they've got an established track record. And I guess I think of the early Chaser team where they did a video on some men's health issue that they sent out that was clearly a joke, and it got a run in a number of television programs because just because it was nicely packaged, it was assumed to be true. And in an environment where there is less time, as well as less analysis perhaps coming out of journalism, and less time in ministers' offices and members' offices as they turn around issues, the chance of influence is completely disproportionate. It probably reflects the packaging, not just the content. So I agree that it's the problem has in fact increased. The quantity of knowledge means we need to do some smarter things, and I don't think we've started yet really to take an approach that actually does the sort of smart analysis that we need in any of the sort of data programs that I've seen doing data visualisation or other things. It's all about representing whatever is the content uncritically. And one of the pieces of research we did in the Parliamentary Library was that there is an increased cynicism, but that doesn't mean that the advertising or the lobbyist advocacy industry isn't trying to be one step ahead of it. It just means that in a hot environment where political decisions and policy decisions are being made regularly, the potential for information that is untrue to get through is even higher than it was 10 years ago in a print-based world. So I agree with you.
It's also more ephemeral, isn't it? I mean, this stuff is not designed for purposes of intellectual rigour. It's not designed to contribute to our total of human knowledge. It's designed to influence. It's designed to propagandise. And once it's done its job, you can kind of... You don't need to keep it on the website. You don't have any interest in keeping it on the website. It might become embarrassing. So I suppose the ephemerality, which I assume has been an issue that's been discussed at length here today, is another issue, because I think we want to capture this stuff, but with context, so that, you know, we've got a clear... It actually improves our understanding of what's going on in the policy-making process. It just so happens that it's not quite in the way that the authors kind of intend.
My patch is education and training, and we see a situation in which far more many people in education and training are looking for grey literature, sometimes unearthing it, often not. Much more grey literature is being produced. In fact, one of our key speakers today had a beautiful graph on a project where there was more grey literature produced in it than of print literature, formerly published material. But in the middle there's a huge gap. And the gap is neither something that you can say is a good thing or a bad thing, or the polemic is X or Y or whatever. It's just darn sight more complex. So in education and training, we're hearing all the time that as people in universities, particularly where most of the studies are looking to access information, one of the things they do have to sort out is this stuff rubbish? Is it genuine? Is it credible? Does it add to the picture or not? And I showed in my speech an increase in the number of blogs. 85% of it is ego-driven or angry people or someone lobbying and a group or an interest group or something like that. But in amongst that, there is, and my figures are not solid at all, there is some little research that's sort of begun to look at it. There's about 10 to 15% of very, very strong, highly credible stuff. But finding it requires quite a degree of sophisticated skill. Critical thinking, I've mentioned, is one. Authenticity is another. Accuracy is another. Credibility, etc. One of the difficulties that people in education and training are finding is locating those people. The confusion comes because most of the people that are writing in those blogging areas have got an axe to grind, or we've enabled people to speak and they've not had the opportunity to speak on a prolific and on a wider distributed basis in the past. So my point is, I think it's just more complex and we require more sophisticated skills to work out where the credibility, authenticity, etc. is.
We have a comment from the floor.
This is a question for the panel. How are you going to be mindful of the dross and the angry people out there using social media platforms, and how are you going to, I guess, try and utilise some of those really rich connections that you've made and there's more people like you. How are you going to get the best of it and filter out the worst? What are your suggestions?
Don't we need to sort of tap into... I mean, there are experts who know what where the quality is, the 10 to 15%. They see the other experts. They can filter it out. We need to kind of, you know, more systemically tap into that. And the angle I want to bring to that is that I think I tried to get this debate up and running in Crikey a couple of weeks ago about the role of the public service in public debate, sparked by the book by James Button. If you don't know, James Button was the guy who worked in the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, but as Kevin Rudd's departmental speechwriter, and then he left after a year and has now written a book about it, which is, of course, a huge no-no in public service terms. But one of his motivations was he was actually astonished as an outsider about the high level of expertise in the public service on particular areas. And he was sitting back thinking, why on earth doesn't the country get the benefit of this expertise more regularly? And that seems to me one area of expertise where, you know, where there is more potential to draw on a capacity to filter out the rubbish and establish that these sources are actually more effective, because public servants, and I assume there are a number here, are kind of, especially at the more junior levels, are, you know, so very restricted in their capacity to actually do that. And my experience when I first joined the public service back in the mid-90s was to discover with kind of horror that a lot of the stuff that I was reading in the media about the area in which I was working was complete rubbish. The journalists had no idea what they were talking about. Once I actually had the faintest understanding about trucks, which was my first area in the public service, I discovered that pretty much everything I'd ever heard from the media about trucks was actually wrong. So there's an enormous pool of expertise in the public sector that's kind of just sitting there very, very carefully isolated. If any public servants or anyone else have got a comment on that, by all means jump in. I'd love to hear it. There's one brave soul.
My name's Petra Bywood. I'm actually a researcher, not a public servant, researcher at Flinders University. But I do work a lot with the public servants in the Department of Health and Ageing. We write a lot of reports for them. And you're absolutely right. The depth of knowledge, in my experience with people that I've worked with, they are looking for evidence-informed, evidence-based policy making. The tendency is now towards evidence-informed rather than evidence-based. So they rely on researchers to critically appraise the material that they're looking at, whether it's peer-reviewed, whether it's grey literature. And they will not accept something that's just on a blog or just an opinion or a commentary. They are very critical themselves. So, you know, take heart, I suppose, that they are listening and they are using evidence to inform their decisions. But just one other point I wanted to say was that when you're talking about where is the evidence, I think one of the first questions is, what is evidence? It's not just information, it's more than that. I think it's really has to be based on something, perhaps whether it's data or quantitative or qualitative data. It needs to be based on something. It just can't be somebody's opinion and somebody's comments.
I think she's just picked up most of what I was going to say.
It always happens, doesn't it?
But primarily that, yes, I think public servants do. I'm a public servant myself, that we do have a reasonably good filter that we operate or that we use when we're trying to develop policy, and that's the same as whether it's there's a lot of self-published stuff out there that's not peer-reviewed that we'd have to look at, but you don't know where the ideas are going to come from that you then might go looking for evidence to back that up. So it's, you know, policy is not just about finding evidence and using that to back your story up. It's about developing a whole lot of ideas and then finding a range of resources.
I guess what we're talking about here is not... When we talk about filtering grey literature, we're not really talking about taking people off the air. We're talking about the kinds of actions we want to take in relation to grey literature to make it more findable, make it more available and so on, the kinds of things that a library like the National Library's Pandora or a service like Australian Policy Online would do in selecting out useful content. So we're not talking about the total web here. We're talking about, I guess, curating, managing grey literature.
Just on Bernard's point, I think it is tricky in that sometimes one of those kinds of documents that you're talking about, obviously from a lobby group on piracy or something like that, comes out and it gets huge media coverage. And at Australian Policy Online, it's a question. Do we put that on because everybody's talking about it, and how can researchers and others refute it if they can't find it and, it's part of the debate? So in this whole area, actually, publishers are very active. So currently we're in a copyright review, and the publishers are putting out their reports and they're saying their argument, which they're entitled to do, and you need to refute that argument, even if the data is not that reputable. And we've been talking a bit today about the whole collection, the role of libraries in collecting and evaluating, as if we're the gatekeepers. But how can we? We're providing access to material. We can't be the gatekeepers necessarily. Our debate has to happen, beyond just librarians and saying you're good research, you're not.
Well, you can't be a gatekeeper when you can't actually get the stuff behind the
fence.
Even
if we're trying to collect it to make sure you can get it, but then that sort of provides a seemingly imprimatur for the material, which we're not intending to do.
We have a comment here.
I thought I might just make one comment too and sort of stand up for the rubbish. One of the things that we've always done is tried to put into, if you like, the collections of the nation, all of the perspectives, whether they're private pamphlets, whether they're private views, letters to the editor. And I think one of the most important things is, particularly for your example of the three copyright reports escalating the dollars, one of the things we need to do is actually put those documents into places that can be accessed so that we can see who's making the arguments, what positions are being put, how the facts are being changed when we do different sorts of research, not to let it disappear, because then people can rewrite history.
Paul Kirban from the National Library. I work with the Pandora Archive, so since it's been mentioned, I think I should say something. The job we do is daily sorting through this stuff. It's a selective archive, and we are turning the digital ephemera, in effect, into artefacts. So the purpose being that there will be long-term access. So this is a constant problem for us trying to work out what we should collect, sorting through the dross, but also having that an eye to the idea that we need to also provide long-term access to that material that might be angry, that might be not well-informed, but has informed a debate. So you sort of need that. But I think the point I would make is that I think we are not even in as good a position as your average, your good journalist that can go through and assess the material that has a long engagement with the material. We're covering everything. When I say we're the people that are selecting this material, so we are not in a position to assess, whether this is always really good material. We do look to people who are suggesting that this material is good, and Crikey is, and your own writing is one of the places we regularly go every day to be alerted to material that we should be collecting. But one important thing I think that is important is that we engage with people that understand this material and that they engage with us, being aware of the work that we do to make sure that material is collected and is made available and preserved for long-term access. The other thing I would say is this material, the people that are producing it need to be more alert or more aware of making it accessible and making it accessible technologically. I mean, when we are collecting material for Pandora, one of the reasons you may not find it in Pandora there may be a couple of reasons, two main reasons. One is an unwillingness to give us permission to collect the material. The second being that it is technologically so difficult to get to that the only efficient means we have of collecting it through web harvesting is not possible. So I think good material, if it wants to be out there and be kept and be made available and get into systems like Pandora and then get catalogued, exposed better, It needs to be made more accessible. We need to be informed of it. I think so. More cooperation, more willingness for publishers to make that material accessible technically and legally. So, I mean, that also then takes us onto the whole copyright and legal deposit regime in Australia, which doesn't help this task.
Question.
It's probably more a comment, but I was struck today by the information in the Prime Minister's office briefs were prepared. Well, I knew that. I always knew they'd be prepared in a hurry, but they were being prepared, drawing on a lot of sources. But I think what happens in policy areas, government departments, even special libraries, and in Queensland that's an issue at the moment with the departmental libraries of the state government, you know, being re-examined, that I think there's a clear understanding in that environment that you're delivering an answer to a question or you're providing content for a policy decision. But what I know is that the public libraries, which are really the state libraries and the local public libraries, are the Cinderellas of the library world, I think. But I think that in that space there's room for a much more transparent exposure of the ideas to the public, a kind of crowd, the wisdom of the crowds, if you like. And it seems to me that making sure that the special libraries and the technical libraries and the research support services are linked in a way to that kind of exposure in a public space, which is a safe environment for lots of different views to be held and exposed and argued about. I think that's something that public libraries, and by that I mean especially the state libraries, have got a role. So I just wonder if any of the panel members wanted to comment on that, because I really think transparency is part of the issue.
I don't know if any of you have read the book on Keating, written by Don Watson.
Oh, Confessions of a Speechwriter.
Yes.
Something like that.
And it's a really, really interesting book.
Confessions of a Bleeding Heart.
Yes. And it, one of the insights that that book gives you is, Keating probably was a very fast policymaker, and faster than some of the people who've come behind him, was that the sort of timetable that he had for responsiveness, even if the people in PM&C stayed up for 24 hours to produce him a creative arts statement, which was what he wanted, it was too late. And so transparency is wonderful and everyone will sign off and say it's a good thing, but the practicalities of politics at times, particularly, you know, leading up to an election period, can just mean that that's a very difficult environment for some areas. It's a really interesting book about the interplay, and Keating was a very strong individual who played policy in his own way, but I think there's a lot of lessons from that. The whole principle of Gov 2.0 and being more transparent works in an environment where you have the chance to have the time to do that. But I think one of the things Tom said at lunchtime as well was, when you're running things through the Prime Minister's office, you don't have 24 hours to do a lot of the research, and that's a challenge.
I also think part of the speed of policymaking is why academics are choosing to publish grey literature as well as the peer-reviewed material. We've looked today, we know the incentives for academics are to publish in peer-reviewed journals, and that's the way the system is entirely set up. But that, you know, a lot of academics working on public policy issues don't want to be part of it. The speed of the cycle means that they have to produce grey literature. So that is really high-quality material. I think there's variations in the quality of the actual production standards, and I think that really needs a bit of work. If everybody's going to be publishers, people need to know how to publish, you know, they need to know how to make sure they put the date on and the authors and the organisation and show where the money came from, show their credibility, show that it came from a university and not a lobby group. Mm. I mean, that's part of... It's not just for the users to have to do some kind of, you know, evaluation. I mean, obviously, users do have to do an evaluation, but the producers need to get much more sophisticated about how they are producing their work.
As you get closer to politics and political power, risk aversion in the public servants and anyone else caught in that area increases, some would say exponentially. And look, I'm a big fan of transparency and talk about transparency all the time and sort of am a public supporter of WikiLeaks, but policymakers do actually need a safe space in which to develop policy often on the run. And the circumstances in which a lot of policymakers find themselves, responding under pressure, responding to very, very tight deadlines, responding in a highly politically charged environment in which public servants won't provide political advice, but they provide advice that is made with, conscious of the political imperatives of their political masters. You know, in the cold light of day, 6 months, 12 months, 30 years later, that can look very peculiar. So I think there's a, whilst I'm probably reflecting the fact that I've worked as both a in the media and as a public servant, that I can sort of urge transparency, but also say I think there should be a safe space where policymakers and politicians and their advisers can actually throw ideas around without it sort of being judged in the sort of context that you'd want final policy to be judged. And that presents a big challenge across, not just grey literature, but, that takes us into areas like FOI and the release of cabinet documents.
Having worked in national policy for about 10 years or so, a bit more at one stage, I did know that, of course, openness operates both ways. If you want to bury a bad report, shove it deep on a website and you can say it's open and everybody can access it. And look it up and it happens. So I'm saying there's also a game that can go on here quite well. And I think it's well practiced.
The sheer volume of data, yeah. The terabytes of data that governments produce every year are a great place to hide stuff that you don't put it out at 6 p.m. on a Friday night and bury it on a website and there's your transparency for you.
That's right. But my second comment was in my patch, in my field of education and learning and digital technologies, cognitive science and so on, if you produce a paper and you produce it for a peer-reviewed journal, there's a set formula you go through. It's not too hard. You can get the paper published. There's a journal somewhere that will do it, and you can pick it quite right. But what's scary is to actually produce a paper and put it up onto a credible site where about 3,000 can have a go at it, who go in and have a look at it. And I can tell you which one I prefer to do. I prefer to go into the traditional journal. I know it's looking at the traditional way of doing things, and I know it's looking at past research, and it's probably going to look at the status quo, and I've got to be very careful if I suggest something for the future, but the other one's much scarier and more exciting.
Thinking about some of the much greater potential we've got now to what we had, say, 15 years ago before the web really got going, one of the things that exists now is that where there is a government inquiry or investigation, submissions are generally placed on an open website, and you get a mass of often really well-researched and argued contributions and some really badly researched and argued contributions too. But it's really a great place for all this sort of stuff. And in copyright, where changes are measured in generations rather than years, it's often good to have a long record of that kind of thing. And this is grey literature. It's really, it is vulnerable. We don't know, say, whether a new Attorney General is going to decide to have a purge of all the stuff and get rid of all of the stuff we've done on previous inquiries and would like to recycle if necessary. But I think the key thing for this kind of grey literature is making sure that it stays around. And I guess the National Library is a key player in that enterprise. And it's not reasonable that we should rely on the government department to maintain a long archive of this kind of material.
Oh, I think it's quite reasonable. Anyway.
Realistic is probably the word I was
going to. Bernard, I think you've probably answered the question that I was going to ask the panellists and yourself, is if there's one thing out of the Grey Literature Strategies research project, what would you like to see for everything to be kept? As one of the archivists in the room, I think that's not.
I know that's a lazy solution.
A good answer. So, for the other panel members, and I guess also perhaps thinking about the audience, what would you like to propose is the one thing that you'd like to see at the end of this research project, or to propose to the audience that they might contribute to?
Just thinking, I wonder what the audience would like to see at the end of the 2 years of our project. What do you think are the burning issues that we should solve? I think infrastructure is a big issue, and collaboration is a big issue, and finding out how we can all work together to provide sort of good solutions. I do think filtering... I totally agree. I think everything should be kept, but then you need to look at the sort of filters that you have in order to provide the information for people to do the kind of, you know, research on the kind of material that they want to access. So just saying, well, it's all on Google, you know, doesn't really solve the problem of getting access to the kinds of material that you want to do, the work that you need to do. So, I think finding collaborative solutions to infrastructure and collecting is the key thing, and improving production. As I said before, I think making people aware that if they're going to be publishers, they need to think about what that means.
I guess the one thing to do would be to make sure that we have... I'm a fan of the legal deposit legislation, should it occur. I think to make sure that it's available somewhere and that we know that it is really important. And I think that applies to the current programs the National Library's got, and to the legal deposit of the future as well. It's very important because we at least know where something is then. What rights we have to use it are also very important. So the second thing that's important, as I would say, of course, is that we need to have copyright legislation that's better attuned to representing the rights of copyright users as well as copyright owners.
I might just make a comment in response to John's very useful comment, because I think we do need to record the evidence, and our understanding of issues changes over time. We used to think the White Australia policy was great, so any report that was written that says it was not very good, you know, if we applied a sort of, you know, fits with common knowledge or doesn't fit the current frame, so we won't save it, we would have lost a whole lot of really important things. And I think there will continue to be changes. So I think part of the challenge, in addition to the things that have been talked about, is just having some more information on what's happening in grey literature, what are the areas that we are at risk of losing that might be particularly important should knowledge change and need to continue to grow, and what strategies should we put around making sure that that's captured for the nation?
I'm a researcher, so you'd expect the answer to be about research, and probably is. I'm a real fan of the Social Science Research Network in the US. It's very thorough, it's very well done, but it's text-based. What I'd really like to see is an infrastructure environment where the reports produced in a particular area to innovate or to make changes are kept and are easily accessible, but not only include text, but audio, graphics, video. The project's about grey literature. If we make a start on that, I reckon that's great. But my dear hope is that we bring in the rich information that's about, that contributes to an area of innovation or change.
Dr. Gerald White, Principal Research Fellow, Training, Learning and Leadership at the Australian Council for Educational Research. Joining him on the panel at last year's Grey Literature Conference were Roxanne Massingham, University Librarian and Chief Scholarly Information Officer at the ANU, Amanda Lawrence, Managing Editor of the website Australian Policy Online, and Derek Whitehead, Director of Information Resources and University Copyright Officer at Swinburne University of Technology. Our thanks to our moderator, Crikey's Canberra-based correspondent, Bernard Keane. Where is the Evidence? Policy Research and the Rise of Grey Literature was a day-long conference at the National Library in Canberra, presented by IDOS and the Swinburne University of Technology. Thanks to the National Library in Canberra for making that recording available to us. That's it for Big Ideas for tonight. Tomorrow, is the concept of public value making a comeback? Hope you can join me then. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.
In terms of brand recognition, people know more about Italy through Berlusconi than they do about most other things apart from pizza and pasta.
Having served three terms as Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi is one of Italy's most successful politicians.
He is very clearly obsessed with being centre stage. He wants to be popular. He wants to be in the middle of things.
But can he win in this week's general election? That's Rear Vision. Download or stream this program from the Radio National website.